Chapter 8. Warping Space-Time. Thus far, we have thought of space-time as fixed and unchanging, something akin to a four-dimensional stage, or the arena within which things happen. We have also come to appreciate that space-time has a geometry, and that the geometry is most certainly not that of Euclid. We have seen how the idea of space-time leads naturally to E equals mc squared, and how this simple equation and the physics it represents has become a foundation stone of both our modern theories of nature and the industrial world. Let us move toward the final twist in our story by asking one last curiosity-driven question. Is it possible that space-time could be warped and curved differently from place to place in the universe? The idea of curved space should not be new to us, of course. Euclidean space is flat, and Minkowski space is curved. By which we mean that Pythagoras's theorem doesn't apply in Minkowski space-time. Instead, the minus sign version of the distance equation applies. We also know that the distance between two points in space-time is analogous to the distance between different places on a map of the Earth, and that the shortest distance between two points is not a straight line in the usual sense of the word. So Minkowski space-time and the surface of the Earth are examples of curved spaces. Having said that, the distance between two points in Minkowski space-time does always satisfy s squared equals c squared t squared minus x squared, and this means that it curves in the same way everywhere. The same can be said for the surface of the Earth. Might it, however, make sense to speak of a surface that curves differently from place to place? What would space-time look like if this were allowed, and what would the implications be for clocks, rulers, and the laws of physics? To explore this admittedly rather arcane-sounding possibility, we shall once again take a step down from the mind-bending four dimensions to the commonplace two dimensions, and focus our attention on the surface of a sphere. A smooth ball is curved the same way everywhere, that much is obvious. But a golf ball, with dimples in it, is not. Likewise, the Earth's surface is not a perfect sphere. As we zoom in, we see valleys and hills, mountains and oceans. The law for the distance between two points on the Earth's surface is only approximately the same everywhere. For a more precise answer, we need to know how the Earth's undulating surface changes as we journey over the mountains and through the valleys between the start and finish of any journey. Could space-time have dimples in it like a golf ball, or mountains and valleys like the Earth? Might it warp from place to place? When we first derived the distance equation in space-time, it seemed that we had no flexibility to change it from place to place. Indeed, we argued that the precise form of the distance equation was forced upon us by the constraints of causality. But we did make a very big assumption. We assumed that space-time is the same everywhere. It is true enough to say that this turns out to be an assumption that works remarkably well, and the experimental evidence is largely in its favour, for this assumption was a crucial one on the road to E equals mc squared. But maybe we have not looked carefully enough. Might space-time not be the same everywhere, and might this lead to consequences that we can observe? The answer is emphatically yes. To arrive at this conclusion, let us follow Einstein on one last journey. It was a journey that caused him 10 years of hard struggle before he arrived at yet another majestic destination, the theory of general relativity. Einstein's journey to special relativity was triggered by a simple question. What would it mean if the speed of light were the same for all observers? His rather more tortuous journey to general relativity began with an equally simple observation that impressed him so much that he could not rest until he had recognized its true significance. The fact is this: all things fall to the ground with the same acceleration. That's it. That is what excited Einstein so much. It takes a mind like Einstein's to recognize that such an apparently benign fact could be of very deep significance. Actually, This is a famous result in physics, known long before Einstein came along. Galileo is credited with being the first to recognize it. Legend has it that he climbed up the Leaning Tower of Pisa, dropped two balls of different masses off the top, and observed that they hit the ground at the same time. Whether he actually carried out the experiment does not really matter. What is important is that he correctly recognized what the outcome would be. We do know for sure that the experiment was eventually performed, not in Pisa, but on the moon in 1971 by Apollo 15 commander David Scott. He dropped a feather and a hammer, and both hit the ground at the same time. We can't do that experiment on Earth, because a feather gets caught by the wind and slows down. But it is quite spectacular when performed in the high vacuum of the lunar surface. There isn't much need to go all the way to the moon to check that Galileo was right, of course, but that doesn't detract from the drama of the Apollo 15 demonstration, and the video is well worth watching. The important fact is that everything falls at the same rate, if complicating factors such as air resistance can be removed. The obvious question is why? Why do they fall at the same rate, and why are we making it out to be such a big deal? Imagine you are standing in a stationary elevator. Your feet press firmly on the ground, and your head pushes down on your shoulders. Your stomach rests in place inside your body. Now imagine you have the misfortune to be inside an elevator that is plummeting towards the ground because the cables have been cut. Since everything falls at the same rate, your feet no longer push onto the floor of the lift, your head no longer pushes onto your shoulders, and your stomach floats freely inside your body. In short, you are weightless. This is a big deal, because it is exactly as if someone had turned off gravity. An astronaut floating freely in outer space would feel just the same. To be a little more precise, as the lift falls, there are no experiments that you can do inside the lift that are able to distinguish between the possibilities that you are plummeting toward Earth or floating in outer space. Of course, you know the answer because you walked into the lift, and perhaps the floor counter is whizzing toward ground at an alarming rate, but that is not the point. The point is that the laws of physics are identical in the two cases. That is what affected Einstein so deeply. The universality of free fall has a name. It is called the principle of equivalence. Generally speaking, gravity changes from place to place. Its pull is stronger the closer to the center of the Earth you are, although there isn't that much difference between sea level and the top of Mount Everest. It is much weaker on the moon because the moon is less massive than the Earth. Likewise, the gravitational pull of the sun is much stronger than that of the Earth. But wherever you happen to be in our solar system, the force of gravity will not vary too much within your immediate locality. Imagine standing on the ground. The gravity at your feet will be slightly stronger than the gravity at your head, but it will be a very small difference. It will be smaller for a short person and bigger for a tall person. You might imagine a tiny ant. The difference in the gravitational pull on its feet compared to its head will be smaller still. Let's travel the well-worn pathways of the thought experiment one more time and imagine smaller and smaller things all the way down to a tiny lift. So small is our lift that the gravity can be assumed to be the same everywhere inside it. The tiny lift is populated by even tinier physicists whose job it is to carry out scientific experiments within their lift. Now we can imagine that the little lift is in free fall. In this case, none of the tiny physicists would ever utter the word gravity. A description of the world in terms of observations made by this group of tiny falling physicists has the astonishing virtue that gravity simply does not exist. Nobody would utter the word gravity in their tiny squeaky voices because there is no observation that could be made within the lifts that would indicate that there was such a thing. But hang on a second. Clearly something makes the Earth orbit the Sun. Is this just some clever sleight of hand, or are we onto something important? Let's leave gravity and space-time for a moment and return to the analogy of the curved surface of the Earth. A pilot planning a trip from Manchester to New York clearly needs to recognize that the Earth's surface is curved. In contrast, when moving between your dining room and your kitchen, you can safely ignore the curvature of the Earth and assume that the surface is flat. In other words, the geometry is, very nearly, Euclidean. This is ultimately why it took a while for humans to discover that the Earth is not flat but spherical. The radius of curvature is very much bigger than the day-to-day distances that we are used to dealing with. Let's imagine chopping up the Earth's surface into lots of little square patches. Each patch is pretty near flat, and the smaller we make the patches, the nearer to flat each one is. On each patch, Euclid's geometry holds sway. Parallel lines don't cross, and Pythagoras's theorem works. The curvature of the surface becomes evident only when we try to cover large areas of the Earth's surface with our Euclidean patches. We need lots of little patches sewn together to faithfully construct the curved surface of the sphere. Now let's return to our little lift in free fall, and imagine it is accompanied by many other little lifts, one at each point in space-time, in fact. The space-time inside each is approximately the same everywhere, and the approximation gets better as the lifts get smaller. Now, recall that in Chapter 4 we were very careful to point out our assumption that space-time should be unchanging and the same everywhere, and this was critical in allowing us to construct Minkowski's space-time distance formula. Since the space-time within each tiny lift is also unchanging and the same everywhere, it therefore follows that we can use Minkowski's distance formula inside each individual little lift. Hopefully, the analogy with the sphere is beginning to emerge. For flat patch on the Earth's surface, read falling lift in space-time. And for curved surface of the Earth, read curved space-time. In fact, physicists often refer to Minkowski space-time as flat space-time for this very reason. Minkowski space-time plays the role of flat Euclidean space in the analogy. In this book, we've reserved the use of the word flat for Euclidean geometry, and the minus sign in the Minkowskian version of Pythagoras's theorem motivated us to use the term curved. Sometimes the use of language is not as straightforward as we might like it to be. So the assembly of little lifts is to space-time as the assembly of little patches is to the sphere. In each little lift, gravity has been banished, but we could imagine sewing all the little Minkowski patches together to form a curved space-time in exactly the same way that we constructed the curved surface of the Earth from the flat Euclidean patches. If there were no gravity, then we could get by with one big lift within which the geometry is that of Minkowski. So what we have just learned is that if there is gravity around, we can make it go away, but only at the expense of making space-time curved. What a remarkable conclusion. Turn this around, and it looks like we have discovered that the force of gravity is actually nothing more than a signal to us that space-time itself is curved. Is this really true? And what causes the curving? Since gravity is found in the vicinity of matter, we might conclude that space-time is warped in the vicinity of matter, and since E equals mc squared, energy. The amount of warping is something we have so far said nothing at all about, and we don't intend to say very much, because it is, to use a well-worn physics phrase, non-trivial. In 1915, Einstein wrote down an equation that was able to quantify exactly how much warping there should be in the presence of matter and energy. His equation improves upon Newton's age-old law of gravity, in that it is automatically in accord with the special theory of relativity. Newton's law is not. Of course, it gives very similar results to Newton's theory for most cases we encounter in everyday life, but it does expose Newton's theory as an approximation. To illustrate the different ways of thinking about gravity, let's see how Newton and Einstein would describe the way in which the Earth orbits the Sun. Newton would say something like this: the Earth is pulled toward the Sun by the force of gravity, and that pull prevents it from flying off into space, constraining it instead to move in a big circle. Actually, it moves in an ellipse, a slightly squashed circle, but it is pretty close to a circle. It is similar to whirling a ball on a string around your head. The ball will follow a circular path because the tension in the string prevents it from doing otherwise. If you cut the string, the ball would head off in a straight line. Likewise, if you suddenly turned off the sun's gravity, Newton would say that the Earth would then head off into outer space in a straight line. Einstein's description is quite different and goes like this. The sun is a massive object, and as such, it distorts space-time in its vicinity. The Earth is moving freely through space-time, but the warping of space-time makes the Earth go in circles. To see how an apparent force might be nothing more than a consequence of geometry, we can consider two friends walking on the Earth's surface. They are told to begin at the equator and to walk due north, parallel to each other, in perfect straight lines, which they dutifully do. After a while, they will notice that they are coming closer together, and if they carry on walking for long enough, they will bump into each other at the North Pole. Having established that neither of them cheated and wandered off course, they may well conclude that a force acted between them that pulled them together as they walked northward. This is one way to think about things, but there is, of course, another explanation. The surface of the Earth is curved. The Earth is doing much the same thing as it moves around the Sun. To get a better feel for what we are talking about, let's return to one of our intrepid walkers on the surface of the Earth. As before, he is told always to walk in a straight line. Locally, that is an instruction he can follow without any confusion, because at any point on the Earth, he can assume Euclidean geometry works just fine, and as a result, the idea of a straight line is clear to him. Even so, he ends up walking in a circular path, although we can think of the circle as being built up of lots of little straight lines. Now let's return to the case of gravity and space-time. The notion of straight lines through curved space-time is entirely analogous to the notion of straight lines on the Earth's surface. The complication arises because space-time is a four-dimensional surface, while the Earth's surface is only two-dimensional. But once again, the complication is more to do with our limited imagination rather than any increase in mathematical complexity. In fact, the mathematics of geometry on the surface of a sphere is no harder than the mathematics of geometry in space-time. Armed with the idea of straight lines, they are also known as geodesics, in space-time, we might be so bold as to suggest how gravity works. We have seen that gravity can be banished in exchange for curved space-time, and that locally the space-time is the flat space-time of Minkowski. We know very well by this point in the book how things move in such an environment. For example, if a particle is at rest, it will remain so unless something comes along and gives it a push or pull. That means it follows a space-time trajectory that moves only along the time axis. Likewise, objects that are moving with a constant speed will carry on moving in the same direction and at the same speed, again, unless something comes and knocks them off course. In this case, they will follow straight lines on the space-time diagram that are tilted away from the time axis. And so, on each tiny patch of space-time, everything should follow a straight line unless acted upon by some external influence. The whole appearance of gravity emerges when we sew all of the little patches together, for only then do the individual straight lines join together into something more interesting, like the orbit of a planet around the Sun. We have not said how to join up the patches in order to build the warping of space-time, and it is Einstein's equation of 1915 that determines exactly how we are to do that. But the bottom line could not be much simpler. Gravity has been banished in exchange for pure geometry. So gravity is geometry, and all things move along straight lines in space-time unless they are knocked off course. But at any given point in space-time, there is an infinite number of geodesics, just as there is an infinite number of straight lines passing through any point on the Earth's surface, or any other surface for that matter. So how are we to figure out which space-time trajectory an object will move along? The answer is simple enough. Circumstances dictate it. For example, the person on the trek around the Earth could start out in any number of directions. He chooses which route to take. Likewise, an object dropped from rest near to the Earth will start out on one space-time geodesic, while one that is thrown will start out on a different geodesic. By specifying the direction an object moves through space-time at any particular point, we therefore know its complete trajectory. Moreover, all objects heading off in that particular direction necessarily follow the same trajectory, irrespective of their internal properties, like mass or electric charge. They just follow a straight line, and that's all there is to it. In this way, the curved space-time view of gravity beautifully expresses the principle of equivalence that so captivated Einstein. Our musings on the nature of space and time have led us to understand that the Earth is doing nothing more than falling in a straight line around the Sun. It is just that the straight line is in a curved space-time, which manifests itself as a nearly circular orbit in space. We have not gone ahead and proved that the Sun warps space-time such that the Earth falls along a geodesic whose shadow in three-dimensional space is nearly a circle. We haven't done it simply because it involves too much mathematics. It also involves us making some statement as to how objects actually warp space-time, and we have been ducking that issue. The mathematical complexity is the main reason why it took Einstein 10 years to develop the theory. General relativity is conceptually rather simple, but mathematically difficult, although the difficulty most definitely does not obscure its beauty. Indeed, many physicists consider Einstein's theory of general relativity to be the most beautiful of all our theories of nature. You may well have noticed that nothing we have said has singled out one type of object over another. In particular, light itself should also move through space-time along a geodesic. In each space-time patch that it passes over, the light travels along one of the 45-degree lines we have introduced in Chapter 4, but upon sewing all the patches together, we will find a trajectory that bends through space. The bending simply reflects the way in which the space-time is warped by the presence of mass and energy. Just as for the case of the Earth in orbit around the Sun, its path through space is a shadow of its four-dimensional geodesic. The power of the equivalence principle and the implied bending of light can be illustrated nicely by another thought experiment. Imagine that you are standing on the Earth and you fire a laser beam horizontally. What happens to it? The principle of equivalence tells us what happens. The light falls toward the ground at exactly the same rate as would an object that is released from rest at the precise moment that the laser is fired. If Galileo had access to a laser and he fired it horizontally off the Leaning Tower of Pisa at the same time as dropping a cannonball, then Einstein predicts that the laser beam would hit the ground at the same time as the cannonball. The problem with this experiment in reality is that the Earth's surface curves away very quickly and the laser would never actually hit the ground because it would run out of Earth. If we imagine instead that we are standing on a flat Earth, then that problem goes away, and we would expect the laser beam to hit the ground at exactly the same time as the cannonball, only a very great deal farther away. In fact, if the cannonball took a second to hit the ground, then the laser would hit the ground one light second from the tower, which is just over 186,000 miles away. The description of gravity as geometry is certainly immensely satisfying, and it leads to quite startling conclusions. But, as we have emphasized throughout this book, it is ultimately useless unless it leads to predictions that can be tested against experiment. Fortunately for Einstein, he had to wait only 4 years for his exotic predictions to be confirmed. The first great test of Einstein's new theory came in 1919 when Arthur Eddington, Frank Dyson, and Charles Davidson wrote a paper titled "A Determination of the Deflection of Light by the Sun's Gravitational Field from observations made at the total eclipse of May the 29th, 1919. The paper was published in the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society of London and contains the immortal words, "Both of these point to the full deflection of 1.77 arc seconds of Einstein's generalized relativity theory." Overnight, Einstein became a global superstar. His esoteric theory of curved space-time had been vindicated following the not inconsiderable efforts of Eddington, Dyson, and Davidson. To see the eclipse, they had to make expeditions to Sobral in Brazil and Principe off the western coast of Africa. The eclipse allowed them to look at stars lurking very close to the sun that would otherwise be obscured by its light. This is the starlight best suited to testing Einstein's theory, because it should be deflected the most since the space-time curvature is greater the closer you get to the sun. In essence, Eddington, Dyson, and Davidson were looking to see whether the stars shifted their position in the sky as the sun passed by. Quite literally, the sun bends space-time and acts like a lens, distorting the pattern of stars on the sky. Today, Einstein's theory has been tested to a high accuracy using some of the most remarkable objects in the universe, spinning neutron stars called pulsars. We met neutron stars and pulsars at the end of Chapter 6, and they are abundant in the universe. Of all the objects we can study accurately from the Earth using telescopes, spinning neutron stars are special in that they provide us with large distortions of space-time and a precise timestamp that rivals the stability of the world's best atomic clocks. If you wanted to dream up an object that would provide the perfect environment in which to test general relativity, you might well come up with a pulsar. Pulsars deliver their timestamp by beaming out radio waves as they spin. You might like to imagine a lighthouse shining out a narrow beam that scans around once every second or so. These wonderfully useful objects were discovered quite by accident in 1967 by Jocelyn Bell Burnell and Tony Hewish. If you're wondering how it is possible to stumble across a spinning neutron star by accident, Bell Burnell was looking for fluctuations in the intensity of radio waves emitted by distant objects known as quasars. The fluctuations were known to be caused by the solar winds in interstellar space. Being a good scientist, however, she was always on the lookout for interesting things in her data, and one November night, she detected a regular signal that she and her supervisor, Hewish, naturally thought was of man-made origin. Subsequent observations convinced them that this could not be the case, and that the signal must come from a source beyond our planet. "I went home that evening very cross," Bell Burnell later said of her observations. "Here was I trying to get a PhD out of a new technique, and some silly lot of little green men had to choose my aerial and my frequency to communicate with us." Although pulsars are fairly commonplace in the universe, there is only one known instance where two pulsars are circling each other. The existence of this double pulsar was established by radio astronomers in 2004, and subsequent observations have led to the most precise test to date of Einstein's general theory. The double pulsar is a remarkable thing. We now know that it consists of two neutron stars separated by a distance of around 1 million kilometers. Imagine the violence of this system. Two stars, each with the mass of the sun compressed into the size of a city, spinning hundreds of times a second and careering around each other at a distance only three times greater than that from the Earth to the Moon. The advantage of having two pulsars for Einstein testers is that the radio waves from one of them sometimes pass very close to the other pulsar. This means that the ultra-regular radio beam passes through a region of heavily curved space-time, which delays its transit. Careful observations can measure the delay and in that way confirm the correctness of Einstein's theory. Another virtue of the double pulsar system is that as the stars orbit around each other, they induce ripples in space-time that propagate outward. The ripples take energy away from the rotational motion of the pair and cause them to slowly spiral inward. The ripples have a name. They are called gravitational waves, and their existence is also a prediction of Einstein's theory. They do not exist in Newtonian gravity. In one of the greatest achievements in experimental science, astronomers using the 64-metre Parkes telescope in Australia, the 76-metre Lovell telescope at Jodrell Bank in the UK, and the 100-metre Green Bank telescope in West Virginia have measured the rate at which the pulsars spiral inward to be just 7 millimetres each day, which is in accord with the prediction of general relativity. The achievement is breathtaking. These are spinning neutron stars orbiting around each other at a distance of 1 million kilometres and located 2,000 light-years from Earth. Their behaviour was predicted to millimetre precision using a theory developed in 1915 by a man who wanted to understand why two lumps of stuff dropped off a leaning tower in Pisa 3 centuries previously hit the ground at the same time. Ingenious and arcane as the double pulsar measurements are, general relativity makes its presence felt here on Earth too, in a much more commonplace phenomenon. The GPS satellite system is ubiquitous throughout the world, and its successful functioning depends upon the accuracy of Einstein's theories. A 24-strong network of satellites circle the Earth at an altitude of 20,000 kilometres, each performing 2 complete circuits every day. The satellites are used to triangulate locations on Earth using precise onboard clocks. In their high-altitude orbits, the clocks experience a weaker gravitational field, which means that space-time is warped differently for them compared to similar clocks on Earth. The effect is that clocks speed up at a rate of 45 microseconds each day. Apart from the gravitational effect, the satellites are also whizzing around at pretty high speeds, around 14,000 kilometres per hour, and the time dilation predicted by Einstein's special theory amounts to a slowing down of the clocks by 7 microseconds each day. Taken together, the two effects amount to a net speeding up of 38 microseconds per day. That doesn't sound like much, but ignoring it would lead to a complete failure of the GPS system within a few hours. Light travels around 30 centimetres in 1 nanosecond, which is 1,000 millionth of a second. 38 microseconds is therefore equivalent to over 10 kilometres in position per day, which wouldn't make for accurate navigation. The solution is simple enough. The satellite clocks are made to run slow by 38 microseconds per day, which allows the system to work to accuracies of metres rather than kilometres. The faster running of the GPS satellite clocks relative to the clocks on the ground can be quite easily understood using what we've learned in this chapter. In fact, the speeding up of clocks is really a direct consequence of the principle of equivalence. To understand how it comes about, let us travel back in time to 1959 to a laboratory at Harvard University. Robert Pound and Glenn Rebke have set about designing an experiment to drop light from the top of their laboratory to the basement, 22.5 metres below. If the light falls in strict accord with the principle of equivalence, then, as it falls, its energy should increase by exactly the same fraction that it increases for any other thing we could imagine dropping. If you know that the potential energy is equal to mgh, then you can easily see that this fractional increase is equal to gh divided by c squared, where g is the acceleration due to gravity and h is the height of the drop. We need to know what happens to the light as it gains energy. In other words, what can Pound and Rebke expect to see at the bottom of their laboratory when the dropped light arrives? There is only one way for the light to increase its energy. We know that it cannot speed up, because it is already travelling at the universal speed limit, but it can increase its frequency. Remember, light can be thought of as a wave motion, a series of peaks and troughs, rather like the water waves emanating outward when a stone is thrown into a still pond. The frequency of the waves is simply the number of peaks or troughs that pass a particular point every second, and these peaks and troughs can be used as the ticks of a clock. In particular, in the Pound-Rebke experiment, you might imagine that Pound is sitting beside the light source at the top of the tower. He can count how many peaks of light are emitted for every beat of his heart. Now suppose that down in the basement, Rebke is sitting beside an identical light source. He too can count how many peaks correspond to each beat of his heart, and he should get the same answer as his colleague, because they are identical light source clocks and identical hearts. Okay, they will get exactly the same number only if they really have identical hearts, and that isn't going to be the case. But we can imagine, for the sake of this argument, that their hearts do beat as one. Now, let's think about how Rebke, sitting in the basement, sees the light that is arriving from Pound's light source at the top. Because the light has gained energy, and thereby increased its frequency, it follows that Rebke finds that the peaks are arriving more frequently than they would if the light source were beside him. But the peaks are synchronized to his colleague's heartbeat. That means that according to Rebke, down in the basement, Pound's heart would be beating faster, and so he would age more quickly. The effect is a tiny one, corresponding to a speeding up of 1 second every 13 million years. It is testament to the skill and ingenuity of Pound and Rebke that they managed to devise an experiment capable of detecting the effect. This speeding up of time is precisely what is happening with the GPS satellite clocks. They are at a much higher altitude than the 22.5 meters of the Harvard laboratory, but the basic idea is just the same. Clocks run faster in weaker gravitational fields. Einstein's general theory of relativity, confirmed beautifully by experiment, has led us to view space-time not as a forever fixed blend of space and time, but instead as a more dynamical entity, one that can be manipulated by the presence of matter, and since through E equals mc squared we know that mass and energy are interchangeable, energy too. In turn, the dynamical structure of space-time controls the way objects move through it. No longer are we to think of space as an inert arena within which things happen, and of time as the immutable and absolute ticking of a giant clock in the sky. Perhaps the most important lesson to learn in the face of this radical revision is that it is not wise to extrapolate experience beyond its realm. Why should fast-moving things behave according to the same laws as the slow-moving things we encounter in everyday life? Likewise, why should we have a right to infer the behavior of very massive objects by studying only the lighter ones? Certainly, our everyday experiences prove to be a pretty poor guide, and, as Einstein has shown us, the deeper level of understanding is so much more elegant. Bringing together as it does such disparate concepts as mass and energy, space and time, and ultimately gravity, Einstein's special and general theories will stand forever as two of the greatest achievements of the human mind. In the years to come, new understanding built upon new observations and experiments may well lead to a revision in the ideas we have presented here. Indeed, many physicists are already anticipating a new order in their quest for more accurate and more widely applicable theories. This humbling lesson not to extrapolate beyond the evidence is not confined to relativity. The other great leap forward in 20th century physics was the discovery of the quantum theory, which underpins the behavior of all things at atomic scales and smaller. Nobody ever would have figured out how nature works at small distances based purely on everyday experience. To human beings, whose direct observations are confined to the big things, the quantum theory is ridiculously counterintuitive. But in the 21st century, it underpins so much of our modern lives, from medical imaging to the latest computing technologies, that we must accept it whether we feel comfortable about it or not. Today, physicists are faced with a dilemma. Einstein's general relativity, our best theory of gravity, cannot be meshed with quantum theory. Either one or both must be revised. Does space-time break up at tiny distance scales? Maybe it does not really exist at all, but is instead only an illusion formed by the ever-increasing set of things that happen. Are the fundamental objects in nature tiny vibrations of energy known as strings? Or does the solution lie in some other theory yet to be uncovered? This is the frontier of fundamental physics, and those standing on the edge are both thrilled and inspired to be looking out into the unknown. At the end of a book on Einstein's theories of relativity, it is all too easy to contribute to an unfortunate cult of personality surrounding the great man, and this is not our intention. Indeed, such a cult probably inhibits future progress, because it gives the impression that science is the preserve of supermen in possession of a unique insight inaccessible to the rest of us. Nothing could be farther from the truth. Relativity was not the work of one man, although in a book about relativity, this can sometimes appear to be the case. Einstein was undoubtedly one of the great practitioners of the art of science, but as we have emphasized throughout this book, he was led to his radical revision of space and time by the curiosity and skill of many. He was not a freak of nature, and his intellect was not supernatural. He was simply a great scientist who did what scientists do. He took simple things seriously and followed through the consequences logically. His genius lay in taking seriously the constancy of the speed of light, as implied by Maxwell's equations, and the equivalence principle, first appreciated by Galileo. Our hope is to have produced a book that allows non-scientists to understand Einstein's beautiful theories. This understanding is within reach for non-experts, because science is really not that difficult. Given the right starting point, the road to a deeper understanding of nature is travelled in small steps, carefully taken. Science is at its heart a modest pursuit, and this modesty is the key to its success. Einstein's theories are respected because they are correct as far as we can tell, but they are no sacred tomes. They will stand, to put it bluntly, until something better comes along. Likewise, the great scientific minds are not revered as prophets, but as diligent contributors to our understanding of nature. There are certainly those whose names are familiar to millions, but there are none whose reputations can protect their theories from the harsh critique of experiment. Nature is no respecter of reputations. Galileo, Newton, Faraday, Maxwell, Einstein, Dirac, Feynman, Glashow, Salam, Weinberg, all are great, the first four were only approximately correct, and the rest may well meet the same fate during the 21st century. Having said all that, we have absolutely no doubt that Einstein's special and general theories of relativity will forever be remembered as two of the greatest achievements of the human intellect, not least in the way they show how powerful imagination can be. From an inspired mix of pure thought and a little experimental data, a man was able to change our understanding of the very fabric of the universe. That Einstein's physics is both aesthetically and philosophically pleasing, while also being extremely useful, delivers an important lesson, the true significance of which is all too rarely appreciated. Science, at its best, is driven by inquiring minds afforded the freedom to dream, coupled with the technical ability and discipline to think. If the society in which Einstein flourished had decided that it needed a new power source to provide for the needs of its citizens, it is impossible to imagine that some enlightened politician would have channeled public funding into an exploration of the nature of space and time. But as we have seen, it was precisely this road that led to E equals mc² and delivered the keys to unlock the power of the atomic nucleus. From the simplest of ideas, that the speed of a beam of light is one thing upon which everyone in the universe should agree, a box of riches was discovered. From the simplest of ideas, if there were ever to be an epitaph written for humanity's greatest scientific achievements, it might begin with these five words. Taking delight in observing and considering the smallest and seemingly most insignificant details of nature has led time and again to the most majestic of conclusions. We walk in the midst of wonders, and if we open our eyes and minds to them, the possibilities are boundless. Albert Einstein will be remembered for as long as there are humans in the universe, both as an inspiration and an example to all those who are captivated by a natural curiosity to understand the world around them. Index. A. Absolute Motion, pages 7, 13 to 14 and 41. Absolute Space, pages 7, 14 and 15. Absolute Time, pages 15 to 18, 34, 35 and 42 to 45. Abstract Thought, page 71. Adams, Douglas, page 72. Allen, Woody, page 6. Alpha Centauri, page 86. Alternating Gradient Synchrotron, AGS, page 51. Altitude, page 72 to 73. Anderson, Carl, page 177. Andromeda, pages 2, 55 and 96. Angular Momentum, page 60 to 61. Antichrist, page 66. Anti-Electron, pages 196, 199, 200, 203 and 204. Antimatter, pages 176, 177, 201, 202, 204 and 209. Antimuon, pages 194 and 208. Apollo 15 spaceship, page 222. Aristotelian grid, page 14. Aristotle, pages 5, 6 to 9, 11 to 12, 14 to 15, 37 and 78. Arrows, page 107 to 108. See also vectors. Artillery shells, page 10. Astronomy, pages 75 and 152. At rest, page 14. Atomic mass, pages 152 to 153 and 159. Atoms, pages 178 and 185. Atoms of hydrogen, page 148 to 153. Axiom, definition, page 40. Axiom of causality, page 81. Axioms of Einstein's theory of relativity, page 40 to 50. B. Bell Burnell, Jocelyn, page 233. Bern, Switzerland, page 38. Beryllium 8, page 163. Big Bang. Page 200. Binding Energy. Pages 149, 153, 160, and 176. Black Holes. Page 168. Bound State. Page 176. Box. World as a. Page 57. Braha, Tycho. Page 10. Brookhaven National Laboratory. Pages 51 to 53 and 192. Brooklyn Bridge. Page 34. Brute, Robert. Page 210. Brunel, Isambard Kingdom. Pages 34 and 130. C. California Institute of Technology. Page 163. Calvino, Italo. The Distance of the Moon. Page 61. Cathode ray tubes, CRTs, page 206. Catholic Church, page 10. Causality, pages 59, 65 to 67, and 110. Causality and space-time, page 79 to 89. Cause and effect, page 65. See also causality. CERN, European Centre for Particle Physics, pages 3, 12, 181, 187, and 205. Chandrasekhar Subramanian. Page 166 to 167. Chandrasekhar's Limit. Page 167. Charged Lepton. Page 176. Chemical Energy. Pages 148. 153 to 156 and 160. Chemistry. Page 152 to 153. China teapot analogy of Bertrand. Page 12 to 13. Claudius Ptolemaeus. Page 9. Clifton Suspension Bridge. Pages 34 and 130. Coal power. Page 146 to 148. Color detection, human eye. Page 152. Conjecture. Page 64. Conservation laws. Page 117. Conservation of energy. Pages 117 to 121, 144 to 145, 146, and 199 to 200. Conservation of mass. Page 131. Conservation of momentum. Pages 111 to 117, 130, 143 to 144, 155, and 200. Conserved quantity. Page 143. Coordinates. Spatial. Page 72 to 73. Time. Page 73. Copernicus. Page 9 to 10. Cosmic speed limit. Pages 3, 87 to 89, 103 to 104, 126, and 137. See also speed of light. Coulomb. Charles Augustin de. Page 183. Curvature of the Earth. Pages 68 to 69, 219 to 222, 224 to 225, and 227 to 228. Curved space-time. Page 219 to 242. D. Davidson, Charles. Page 232. Davy, Sir Humphrey. Pages 17, 18, 174, and 181. Democritus. Page 136. Deuteron. Page 159 and 204 to 205. Dimensions. Pages 71 to 72 and 228. Dirac, Paul. Pages 176 and 177. Displacement current. Page 25 to 26. Distance. Pages 106 to 108 and 219 to 222. Distance and space-time. Pages 59, 70 to 91 and 225. Distance of the Moon. Calvino. Page 61. Double pulsars. Page 233 to 235. Dyson, Frank. Page 232. E. Earth. Early. Page 161. Formation of. Page 2. Geology. Page 157. Motion of. Pages 10 to 11 and 227 to 228. Position in solar system. Page 6 to 8. Eddington, Sir Arthur. Pages 172 and 232. Edison, Thomas. Page 18. Egyptians, ancient. Page 9. Eiffel Tower. Page 34. Einstein, Albert. Pages 1 to 5, 14, 15, and 59. Early career. Page 37 to 39. God does not play dice. Page 190. General theory of relativity. page 221 to 238. Special Theory of Relativity, page 37 to 55. Electricity, pages 140 to 141 and 183. Discovery of, page 18. And magnets, page 18 to 19. Electromagnetic fields, page 19 to 20. And the speed of light, page 28 to 29. Static electricity, page 27. Electromagnetic induction, page 19. Electromagnetism, pages 21, 23 to 29, 62, 153, 156, and 184 to 185. And weak nuclear force, page 186. Electron fields, pages 190 and 191 to 192. Electron volt, page 148 to 149. Electron positron pair, page 208. Electron, page 51. Electrostatic repulsion, page 183. Elementary particles, pages 50 to 52 and 181 to 182. Elements, Euclid, page 40. Elevator analogy, page 223 to 224. Empirical observation, page 11 to 13. Energy, binding, pages 149, 153, 160 and 176. Chemical, pages 148 and 153 to 156. Conservation of, pages 117 to 121, 144 to 146 and 199 to 200. Defining, page 119 to 120. As heat, pages 119 and 145 to 146. Hydroelectric plants, page 155. Kinetic, pages 121, 133, 139 to 140, 143 to 145, and 155. And mass, pages 135 to 136 and 141 to 148. Negative, page 149. Nuclear, page 156 to 169. Nuclear versus chemical, page 160. Wind and sea, page 155. Energy momentum 4 vector, page 136. Englert, François, page 210. Equations, pages 20 to 25, 63 to 64, and 104. Fundamental, page 104 to 105. Symmetry of, page 187 to 188. Equator, page 5. ETH, Swiss Federal Institute of Technology, page 38. Ether, page 29 to 32. Euclid, page 40. Euclidean geometry, pages 40, 69, 76, 219, and 224 to 226. European Centre for Particle Physics, CERN, pages 3, 12, 181, 187, and 205. Event in space-time, page 72. Experiment, definition, page 12. Experiments, pages 11 to 15 and 176 to 177. For relativity of time, page 49 to 55. Thought, page 42 to 43. I, human, pages 152 and 180. F. F equals MA, page 114. Faraday, Michael, pages 17 to 21 and 58. Femtometer, page 160. Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory, Fermilab, Chicago, page 213. Feynman, Richard, pages 15, 41, 184, 194 to 198, and 214. Fields, concept of, page 20 to 21. Finnegan's Wake, Joyce, page 178. Flat space-time, page 225 to 226. See also Minkowski space-time. Flux lines, page 20. Force, definition, pages 27 and 114. Forces of nature, pages 62 and 183 to 184. Fundamental equations, page 104 to 105. Fusion, definition, page 159. Fusion, nuclear, pages 158 to 169, 171 to 172, and 202 to 204. And heat, page 160 to 162. Future, travel to, page 4. Future light cone, page 109. G. Galileo Galilei, pages 5, 10 to 14, 16, 37, 41, 189, and 221 to 222. Gamma rays. Page 180. Gases. Pages 144 to 145, 152, and 154 to 155. Gauge symmetry. Pages 188 to 193 and 210 to 217. Gel Man, Murray. Page 178 to 179. General Theory of Relativity. Pages 10, 76 and 221 to 238. Geodesics. Pages 70 and 228. Geometry. Pages 40, 58 to 59 and 219 to 220. Euclidean. Pages 40, 69, 76 and 224 to 226. Gravity as. Page 228 to 232. Non-Euclidean. Page 69 to 70. Glashow, Sheldon. Pages 187 to 188, 191 and 193. Gluons. Pages 180, 186, 196 and 215. God does not play dice. Einstein. Page 190. GPS satellite system. Page 234 to 238. Grand Unified Theory. Page 184. Gravitational waves. Page 234. Gravity. Pages 62 and 175. And curved space-time. Page 221 to 238. And Earth's orbit. Page 227 to 228. And Einstein. Pages 76, 221 to 222. And 226 to 229. As geometry. Page 228 to 232. On the moon. Page 223. Newton's law of. Pages 10 and 226 to 227. And the sun. Page 227. Variability. Page 223 to 224. And weight. Page 114. Great Circle. Page 68. Great Fire of London. Page 66. Green Bank Telescope. Page 234. Greenwich Meridian, pages 5 and 73. Guralnik, Gerald, page 210. H. Hagen, Carl, page 210. Half-life, page 156. Harvard University, page 236 to 238. Heat and fusion, page 160 to 161. Heat energy, pages 119 and 145 to 146. Heavy carbon. Page 163. Helium. Page 152. Burning. Page 162 to 163. Hewish. Tony. Page 233. Hida. Japan. Page 164. Higgs. Peter. Page 210. Higgs Field. Page 211 to 212. Higgs Mechanism. Pages 139 and 211 to 216. Higgs Particle. Page 212 to 217. Hoyle, Fred. Page 163. Huxley, Thomas Henry, page 82. Hydroelectric plants, page 155. Hydrogen atom, pages 148 to 149, 150 to 152, and 152 to 153. Hydrogen gas, page 154 to 155. Hyperbola, pages 83 and 110. Hyperbolic space, page 82 to 83. Hypotheses, testable, page 11 to 15. I. Industrial Revolution, pages 21 and 140. Infrared light, page 180. Interaction of particles, pages 175 to 176, 179 to 184, 188 to 189, and 192 to 217. Interaction vertices, page 195 to 197. Of Higgs particle, page 214. Interferometry, page 31. Invariance, page 58 to 64 and 104 to 105. Rotational, page 59. Translational, pages 60 and 113. Invariant quantities, page 104. Ionian enchantment, pages 78 and 91. Iron, page 164 to 165. J. Janssen, Pierre, page 152. Joule, James, page 140. Joyce, James, Finnegan's Wake, page 178.